It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit.
Hello and welcome to this. It's the Last Week in Brexit podcast. As usual, I'm joined by Alex Davis.
Hiya.
And also Christian Spence.
Hello, happy New Year.
Now, unusually, we actually have a guest, but before I introduce our guest, please remember to follow us on Twitter. Gents, where is our Twitter accounts?
I'm at GMCC underscore Alex.
And I'm at GMCC underscore Christian.
And of course, I'm at Jay Beardmore. If you want to leave us an iTunes review, that would be very, very much appreciated. But we do have a guest, so I will introduce him now. It's Mr. Oliver Norgrove.
Good afternoon. How are you doing? Thank you for having me.
Not a problem at all.
First time in Manchester, right here?
It is my first time in Manchester,
is,
yeah.
And, is it really?
Any excuse to get... feels like a holiday, I won't lie, because I'm in the kind of southeast bubble a bit. So when I travel, it's a pretty good... it's a good excuse to get away, so first time.
Now, before we get into anything, if anyone finds you on Twitter or some such thing, the first thing they'll notice is you were a Vote Leave staffer.
Yes.
Now, you're sitting in front of me, full head of hair, young man. How does one become a Vote Leave staffer?
Basically, I got the job through impressing in the interview. I started out really as an activist. I did a lot of volunteering for Vote Leave. I did a lot of travelling around the country, a lot of the groundwork that goes into a campaign. And that's how they kind of began to familiarise themselves with me. And I think that really helped me in terms of getting a job with them, gaining employment. I worked in communications. I worked on social media channels. And that's been really how I... That's how I got my kind of, I guess, head start in the world of Brexit, which is a very kind of insular world. So it's everybody kind of knows everybody. Mm. But, yeah, so that's really been my journey. I've mixed in very various circles. I used to be... I was originally Eurosceptic in UKIP, but I left shortly after. I wasn't there long. I didn't like it either. And I was with Vote Leave for a few months. And after that, my position kind of on Brexit changed. And I now advocate a single market Brexit, the so-called Norway option. So it's been a bit of a journey. So I've been lucky to be a part of it, really.
Now, at what point did you decide, okay, the thing that I want to do is go on the UK campaigning against the EU?
To be honest, I supported Brexit because I see it as a way of shortening the chain of accountability just in terms of our political democracy. But as for me personally, I'm very driven. And when I have my mind set on something, I try my best to go out and get it. So I really tried to put myself out there, meet as many people as I could, kind of integrate myself in the campaign setup. And that was really how I managed to kind of carve out my own little corner in the intellectual and public domain of Brexit. Basically, it's a combination of drive and my own kind of principled belief in it.
Mm. So you've already said that you've gone from a Brexit campaigner and now looking at this Norway style option. Is that a marked change of attitude from where you were to where you are now?
Yes, I think I was initially a lot harder, but I was reasoned into the position. I don't think that it's plausible that the UK will leave in the single market in any meaningful sense. And you see this coming, you largely see evidence from this from industry. So industry is very kind of adamant, from pharmaceuticals to agriculture, that they want to remain aligned to the regulatory architecture of the European model. And also I think that the beauty of a single market Brexit is that it allows us to leave the EU without becoming in practice a third country. So we are allowed to operate within frameworks that we understand, regulatory frameworks, administrative systems, these kind of things. So it's a way of ensuring maximum kind of continuity and stability whilst regaining the important parts and pockets of sovereignty and our domestic cult, forget the word I'm looking for, but I think it is the best way of leaving. Though having said that, I don't think there is enough time now to join EFTA. I think we're looking now at a bespoke EEA model, so our own kind of distinct arrangement.
Now, that kind of distinct arrangement would be more like a Switzerland arrangement, say, than a Norway arrangement.
Well, Switzerland isn't in the single market, but it would be similar. The thing about the Swiss model is that it's not a model. And the reason why I say it's a model is that it was essentially cobbled together after its people voted against single market membership in a referendum in December 92. And that was that shocked the Swiss establishment and shocked the European establishment. So they've spent the last 25 years basically saying, okay, let's just put this together and tie this together and this together. And they have now 123 bilateral agreements between them. So that's why I don't really see it as a model. So we're doing the reverse. Mm.
Yeah, well, I'll just open this up to you, Sinan.
Sorry.
No, absolutely not. would that been? I've never heard the Swiss situation being described in that manner before. So with that in mind, why are we getting so much noise from the EU, which almost sounds like it's obstruction? As in, this sort of pragmatic approach just isn't open to the UK.
I think part of it is just the EU is trying to set out its red lines in all of this as well. You know, so we've talked in previous podcasts about, you know, their firmness in terms of the indivisibility of the four freedoms, that essentially the only two offers on the table for the UK government practically at this stage, that they want to say anyways, essentially an EEA-EFTA Norway approach or a Canada-style approach. The Canada-style approach is essentially the only one which fits with Theresa May's red lines, as they are now. Mm-hmm. And also, the EU is bruised from that referendum with Switzerland. You know, we talked about before, because people said, why doesn't the UK go for a Swiss approach? Is that the EU will not, even if you hold a gun to their head, go for it. It's a pain in the neck for them. It's also because actually it's a pain in the neck for Switzerland, but it's worth it because it gives them the access. They're not technically in the single market, they're practically in the single market.
Yes.
So it smooths a lot of hurdles for them. Interestingly, of course, they're not in the single market for financial services, which is one of the big outliers. But it's a headache for the EU, it's a headache administratively. Nobody wants to be going through these bilaterals, which don't, in the most part, automatically update in the way they do if you're working through the EU.
I mean, isn't that half the problem, that we don't want all these things automatically updating should we leave the EU?
Well, that comes down to a much bigger question, doesn't it? Which is, I mean, Christian just mentioned the two strategies of the EEA kind of route or the Canada route. And I think you said it's not either or. It's kind of which direction do we want to go in? And it comes down to the question of regulatory convergence or regulatory divergence in the future. And that's going to be the big debate, which I think no one has really properly grasped in government at this point.
I describe it as two boxes. The important thing about EEA in Canada is that it's not a spectrum, because there's nothing in the middle. The two are conceptually different, and they are designed to be conceptually different. And this can be seen in many ways. So the main difference, I would say, the noticeable one between an FTA and the single market is that it's basically a change in enforcement and surveillance strategy, so where the checks come in. As they come in production, or they come in at the border. That's basically one of the main differences. So the way I look at it is we have two different boxes. We have a Norway box and we have a Canada box. And we open the box, and that's the one we choose, and then we start fighting and kind of wrestling. But we can't. There's no spectrum, because there's a complete gulf.
And that gulf is large as well. I think we talked previously. You know, people within all this seem to have in mind a spectrum. What if we say sort of three boxes of, you know, WTO on one side, Canada in the middle, single market membership EA or continuity membership on the farm side. But everyone's got the mind that kind of those three boxes are equally spaced. And they're not.
No.
The difference between WTO and Canada is actually relatively small.
Yes.
But the gap between single market membership and Canada is enormous. Mm-hmm. You know, single markets are rare things, very, very rare.
And our supply chains are very, very sensitive to any kind of change like that.
Absolutely. And it is changing. We talk often here about regulation. When companies complain about regulation, usually what they're complaining about, if you dig under the surface of Shouty, is the rate of change. So we talk about the velocity of regulation being a major issue rather than regulation.
You mean too much coming in at one time?
Exactly. How quickly it changes. It's essentially customising yourself to it. Once it's been in place for a year or two, the systems are designed, supply chains have relocated, everything does what it does, everybody's now happy. So when people come back, it's one of the things we've had to push hard back against, kind of the hard leave approach.
Mm.
Is this narrative that, oh well, you know, most of the world isn't in the EU, therefore we can be fine. We can, you know, it's okay for the UK to be out. Of course it's okay for us to be out, but the difference is we're currently in.
Mm.
The rest of the world hasn't been in, and therefore their supply chains are located on the basis that they're not in. But actually all of our industrial supply chains across Europe are entirely located and set up.
And many of them,
we are in a single market.
And many of them run in a just-in-time fashion.
Exactly.
So companies will import, Nissan is a good example.
Yeah.
I think they have a factory in Swindon, and they will import part, and their production line is literally an hour long. So their parts will come in, and they will not stand there for very long, and they will go in towards building the products, and off the cars go. Like, it's very, very quick.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that mentions of Nissan in Sunderland have gone up 20-fold post-Brexit. Shall we move this on to more recent events?
Yeah.
A couple of things which have interested me in the news lately. A, there's been a reshuffle.
There was.
Not a particularly interesting one.
I think the political outfall is probably more interesting than the actual shuffle itself.
Yes, I tend to agree with that. Another one which I'd just like everyone's opinion is Nigel Farage's meeting with Michel Barnier.
Yeah, I saw a lot of people getting outraged that this was happening, but Nigel Farage is an MEP, and MEPs regularly meet with officials from the UK.
Yes.
Yeah, it got framed in a kind of weird...
It may have been the way that he built it up himself through his own social media.
Yeah. You must have seen the social media video that he did and all the replies.
I didn't, actually.
It's worth taking some time to go through.
It's funny.
To go through the replies. He basically asked people what questions he would like they would like him to pose to Barnier, and some of the replies were pretty funny. I recommend you go through them.
Oh no, I love a reshuffle. Reshuffle to me is like transfer deadline day. It's the best. I love a reshuffle. I don't think it was the best reshuffle we've seen, but they're always interesting. How Grayling kept his job is to me a mystery.
Absolutely.
Why Justin Greening was extricated from government, I don't understand that either. Boris Johnson.
How was she extricated? Did she not resign?
She resigned. Yeah.
I should have said from her position. So she was moved to another department to.
Yeah.
The work and pensions, I think, and she
That's
rejected
right.
it.
The current climate, I mean, DWP is a bit of a poison chalice at the minute with universal credit rollout not as well as it might.
I mean, the one interesting one for me was Jeremy Hunt. I know this has nothing to do with Brexit, but I'm going to mention it anyway. Talking about a poison chalice, why would you want to carry on as health secretary?
Well, I mean, his own statement said this is a personal mission. He doesn't want to be seen to be going down with the sinking ship, I think was the line he used in his letter to Theresa May.
Really?
I think he said going down with the ship, and then Corbyn pounced on that today and said if he's does that mean it's a sinking ship?
Yeah, that's it. So he'd said we've got doctors and nurses under huge stress in the last crisis before the NHS caves in, which the NHS has had every single year that I can remember.
Well, it's annual crisis season, of course, isn't it?
The one position I was glad to see remain the same was Michael Gove as the DEFRA secretary. He's had a blinder over 6 months.
Yeah.
He's a Marmite politician.
Yeah, I like him personally.
And I think actually for most people it's probably the policies he's pursued. But I think generally, in terms of a cabinet minister who has actually got on and achieved things, since 2010, he's got to rank up there highly. Disagree on the policies themselves,
pesticides,
the ability to actually design, shape a policy, and then deliver it rapidly. I mean, around half the actual Brexit policy announcements we've had in the past few months have all come from DEFRA.
Mm. Well, I know you, Oliver, were a big fan of the farming announcement around the subsidies, which I thought didn't get a lot of press coverage, to be honest.
No, I think it's because it's a very kind of technical, boring issue. But I think Gove is in an interesting spot because the common agricultural policy is widely condemned across the referendum spectrum. It's one of those systems which is, in my view, structurally flawed. Subsidies are based upon wealth and not based upon productivity or output. And what we've seen in the UK is large segments of our greenery has been completely destroyed just to be replaced by basically useless farmland. And what Gove is saying is we should bring back the wildflower fields that we've lost almost all of over the last kind of 50, 60 years. And I think these are very kind of... What he's showing is that Brexit can in some ways be an opportunity to instill in our political climate some refreshing, interesting ideas. And that's one of the reasons why I think he's doing a very good job in his role at the moment.
Yeah, I think I'm of the same opinion as both of you here, which is I find him a remarkably effective minister.
Mm. Yes.
In both his briefs.
He was in education as well. Yeah. Only justice he wasn't, but he wasn't there long. He's a very nice guy, and he's a very... back of Oak Leaf, he occasionally would come in and give us all kind of rallying speeches. And he's one of those politicians, one of those great orators where he just, the words kind of roll off of his tongue and he kind of captures you. And it's really, he's really interesting to watch. He's one of those politicians that really kind of inspires me. And I'm not saying I agree with everything he does, but he's just one of those politicians you have to kind of listen to because I just find him interesting.
Yeah. I guess whilst we're on the subject then, and as Brexit is a very small world, as you said yourself, you must have encountered Nigel Farage.
I've met him probably three or four times. But I wouldn't say he knows me though. Just in brief, in passing. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of his. I used to be a massive fan of his. I used to be kind of very intrigued by him and interested in him, but not so much anymore. Why do you ask about Farage?
Because
I wasn't hostile question. I was just wondering.
I'd like to know how the Brexit side is now polarised post vote.
Oh yeah, the divisions have been really pronounced. You still have the hardliners. I call them headbangers, but that's just me being annoying. So you have the Leave types who think that a no deal is in some way feasible, plausible, acceptable. Those are the people we need to ignore because they're wrong. You have the softies like me, and then you have a very subtle divide between people like me and people like Dan Hannan, who also supports EFTA, but he supports the Swiss type, which is very similar. But mainly I think the consensus is that the negotiations are not going well. We need to get out control of our borders, have a free trade agreement. But there are still these visible splits in the Leave side, and they've always been there. It's not new. There have always been different proposals for what Brexit should look like. The Norway option, for instance, was first proposed back in 2004 by a member of the European Research Group in Brussels, and then Dr. Richard North proposed his own kind of take on the Norway option, and that kind of took off, and we had that in Flexit as well. So there have always been, and these camps can get very hostile with one another, because it is about the future of the country. It's about the future of, it's about the direction we head in as a country. So it is actually very important, I think.
One of the things which came out of the Farage meeting was immigration, and he said that it hasn't been, well, except from his discussion, it sounds like it has not been addressed at all. How much truth is in that statement?
Addressed in what way?
Within the Brexit negotiations.
Immigration policy has not been touched at all yet. That will be part of the framework for future discussions, so we're probably another 7 or 8 months away from knowing what the policy might look like. No, all we've covered is citizens' rights, existing EU citizens, EU27 citizens here, and their families and dependents, and vice versa. That's all we've got through. So all we know is what we know on migration, what we've known since whenever it was Theresa May or David Cameron wanted the immigration reducing to the tens of thousands. That's literally all we know. That's still policy at this stage. As to how we will control it, we have no real idea. Migration bill to come this session.
What surprised me was how surprised Mr. Farage was about the fact that it hadn't been discussed. Because
yes.
we know the sequencing.
Yeah,
it's already public. What was he expecting? Some kind of massive alteration to it. And also, it's not relevant. It's not relevant at the moment. It's relevant soon, but not yet.
And that's been the challenge all the way through this process, is lots of people who should be better informed than they are shouting about things that aren't pertinent at the time they're shouting about.
You know, so I actually do have a little bit of sympathy with this comment. And the reason I do is because throughout doing this podcast, you would say things like, oh, well, you know, nothing's been decided, or, you know, people are not talking about X, Y, and Z. And then what has become apparent is that everyone is talking about everything all of the time. So I am actually surprised that there was nothing that you could glean from his meeting with Michel Barnier.
Well, because the answer is it depends.
Yeah.
it depends. We're entering a set of negotiations.
That's the answer to every Brexit question.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're entering a set of negotiations where nothing is known. The likely outcome is, for me, I would say at this stage, the likely outcome is the UK will essentially take whatever it is the EU offers. Because we said from the beginning, I think one of the big flaws in the Theresa May government strategy, particularly since the Lancaster House speech, is this idea that you can sort of just wing it and we can really hammer our way through.
Which is kind of what has gone on so far.
It is, yeah. We just hammer our way through and then capitulate at the last minute and present it as a negotiation success for David Davis. Where, you know, we've said this a lot.
Yeah.
You know, we should have been much more open at the beginning and acknowledging that we do have a very weak set of cards in this negotiation. That's not necessarily a problem if you acknowledge it and you set your expectations with what can happen. But migration, it's a trade. You know, I use this phrase so often in my job. You know, economics 101, first thing you learn, everything is a trade-off. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as a free lunch. For your migration policy, okay, you want to restrict migration from free movement, then the UK government, you need to decide which bits of access, of preferential access, to the EU market you now don't want.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it appears that there is no
because they come as a package
access that we don't want.
Because they come as a package.
That's it. Mm. So, yes, there will be some room for manoeuvre. The EU is, and I think we've also forgot this, the EU is, it will not give away on its fundamental principles, but it is very, very good in its negotiations with both internally, with its member states, and around the world, at managing to politically fudge things. It has a great expertise in managing to present something as A whilst actually giving B. It won't collapse on the big stuff, but it can present it. So the Brexit bill, you know, the divorce bill, horrible phrase, you know, they've managed to spin it. The media's caught on, it's 40 billion. We all know practically it's 58 billion because we'll pay some of it up front, so it doesn't look like it's going to be larger than it is. They're very happy to do this kind of political spin. But you know, the one conversation the UK government has had, there's two conversations that are connected that they've not had for me. One is they've not really set out what it is they want to achieve. I think this is the single biggest failing of their whole process. We don't know why we're doing this, other than, quote, will of the people, unquote. Mm. So what do you want to achieve once you're outside of it?
Basically, characterising the whole thing has been a complete lack of clarity.
Yeah, exactly. And then secondly, this will involve trade-offs. So where are all of the different aspects of our relationship with the EU ranked? Which bits are you prepared to give up to be able to win something here on the other side? And we've no clarity on any of those things. And at the moment, the UK government is pretending it can have all of the bits that it wants and get rid of all the bits that it can't.
I think the thing is, with going back to people like Farage as well, is that they are never going to be satisfied. And I think that goes more widely, and I think I've said this before, is that I don't think that anyone is really ever going to be satisfied with how Brexit turns out. Because, I mean, there's such diversity of thought within the Leave side. You know, Remainers are always going to be unhappy if Brexit happens. I don't think that it's possible to deliver a Brexit which actually pleases anyone entirely.
The thing about Farage is that his entire life and political side has been devoted to it. So even if he's internally satisfied, he can't be publicly, because he will only himself look like he's undermining himself, that makes any sense.
Yeah. I just think he'll move on to the next project. I mean, it used to be all about...
His next project.
Lack of sovereignty.
he will intoxicate his next project.
Yeah, but if you think about where he was, which is kind of, you know, Thatcher plus, and then look at him where he is now, which is, you know, almost this Trumpian fan, you know, populist and anti-immigration. I'm not saying he's not always held those views, but the views that he is most prominent with have certainly changed. Mm. So he'll just.
He'll write a book and he'll be a talk show host on a radio or on radio or something like that.
I think he's very good at that, to be fair.
And his book will go on about how weak the establishment were in standing up to Brussels, despite the fact that that's not the paradigm the negotiations actually sit in at all.
Because we've got an outside opinion here, I'll just throw two questions to you, which we started with about five minutes ago, which is. How do you rate the outcome of the negotiations so far? And what was the other one that you spoke about? It's escaped me. Go with that one.
How do I think of the negotiations so far? I think that the Phase 1 agreement essentially pretty much confirms that soft Brexit is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm referring specifically to the Irish border, and the Northern Ireland issue is now pretty much guiding Brexit policy. I'm not, in terms of my general views, I'm not impressed. Like, I'm not impressed with the lack of clarity. I'm not impressed with the lack of just the general understanding and getting to grips with what becoming a third country means. The general cakeism, I dislike. I really despise it, because all it does is it puts up this enormous goal that we can never achieve, and it'll make the whole thing look like a failure. And I think we've been very slow. Our ministers are completely disorganised. The civil service is completely suffocated by this. I will support it. I support it very strongly. There's nobody who supports Brexit more than I do. And I get a lot of grief from hard leavers who think I'm anti-Brexit because I criticise the process, which is, obviously, I have my own mind. But my general feeling is that I'm pretty pessimistic about where it's going. And I think that Phase 2, one of the things I advocate at the moment is an extension to the Article 50 period, because I think that Phase 2 will be even trickier than Phase 1. If we think that the island discussion ended with Phase 1, it's not even started.
No, and that's one thing we talked about. On the North Island border, all they've had to do is kick the single most difficult can in this entire process further down the road.
Yeah.
That problem has not been resolved.
One thing I will say, though, is that there is enormous political will to solve it.
There is, and
there's an interesting article on the CAPEX website at the moment about how Ireland can be our best friend during the Phase 2 negotiations. And it may seem like we're fighting against them, and we kind of are in that they are the EU. But one thing I would say is that Ireland is also determined for there not to be a border.
Yes.
So it's not like there's no cooperation on that front, and that will help, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
I have remembered the second point, which you said, which we talk about most weeks. How strong do you think the UK is in its negotiating position? Because I think you refer to it most weeks that you believe it's a relatively weak hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that broadly. I think we're relatively weak. Though I think if you look at the initial demands of Phase 1, 100 billion, continued and more extensive jurisdiction of the ECJ, we did actually manage to water those down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like one side completely capitulates and the other side gets exactly what it wants.
Yeah.
There has been a watering down. So I think you're broadly correct, and we are on the weaker side, and we're on the weaker side because basically it's not true that they need us more than we need them.
Yeah.
That's basically the crux of the issue. They say, oh well, half of our exports go there, so they need us. Well, I mean, we're talking about proportions here. 15% of their trade comes here. For us, it's much higher. And I think we're in those terms much. The odds are stacked against us. So I do broadly agree that we're in a weak position.
Yeah. And I think my frustration with that is of course we had a weak hand because essentially we're more than 1/28 of the year practically. But it's the fact that even before the Lancaster House speech, Theresa May's conference speech last October, which suddenly introduced red lines. Realistically from nowhere, this pretense, all you talked about, that imagining we can have our cake and eat it, just sets you up for failure.
Exactly.
No politician,
they don't realise it,
ever goes out, the businessman, you would never do it, we're going to go do X to get this. There's simply no way I can ever do that. So you go into failure. All of that essentially made our hand weaker. That's the frustrating part. So we start with a weak hand, but actually, like business negotiations, if you're honest and open about what you can achieve, it's not necessarily
exactly. And also being constructive about it will help progress things in principle.
Yeah.
One of the core kind of arguments I have with harder levers is that, I mean, recently I wrote a blog post. I do quite a lot of blogging, completely littering people's news feeds with it, about why there's no such thing as regulatory sovereignty.
Yeah.
And there are basically two reasons. One is the globalised trends, basically lots of these regulations come from global bodies and we will adopt them anyway. Yep. Another point is that we face what is effectively a binary choice between the American model and the European architecture. And the hard levers who had a go at me for writing this were saying, oh, I was just basically, I was undermining Brexit. I was saying that I'm making Brexit out to be harder than it actually is. I'm pessimistic. I'm not a true Brexiteer is another one they use. But what I'm trying to say is exactly what you've just said. If you set up a goal you can actually score in, you can actually work with it and you can actually progress. But they do not grasp this, and it's so frustrating for me.
No, and the hardness is great. The how difficult this is. I think it's the great. I always come back to David Alan Green's writing the FT. He always said it's actually the single biggest failure I like this, that government has made him on is to pretend that this is easy. it's actually that you are entering realistically the single most challenging regulatory discussion that any major country has gone through in 50 years or more.
I would
pretend that is simple is incredibly dangerous.
Naive. I would add on to that that I think the single biggest problem, the core problem with our attitude towards negotiations has been that we have taught ourselves over quite a few years now that it's in the interests of the EU to offer us a preferential deal, when it isn't, because that undermines the integrity, functional and political integrity of the single market, and that's what we've completely avoided and just completely ignored.
Yeah, well, I think there's a further aspect. Like there's that, you know, the EU has its own internal obligations within its own treaties. The EU also has a web of international obligations. So, you know, starting to do, you know, crack deals with us about, oh, we can throw services in. More point for you have to go back to the global negotiating table with a number of countries if you start to do that. Because MFN, we talked about it a couple of podcasts ago. MFN.
Interestingly, though, the EU does have a right of reservation on Canada. So in the case of services, they have a right of reservation on one, and one of the grounds is that they can offer preferential treatment to another country if that country begins from the point of regulatory equivalence, which we do.
Yeah.
That being said, I'm not arguing that we would get perfect on financial services and FDA because we're talking about, again, trade-offs, like you said.
Was there not an announcement today or yesterday that they wouldn't give us passporting financial services?
No, and that was before Christmas, I believe. Passports.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it wasn't during the last Barnier speech, and that's not a surprise. Because what they have, because they've not said you can't have it. They've said we're not really interested in opening up full-blown passporting, but I'm sure we can crack a deal on the basis of equivalence.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that actually gives firms in London everything they need except long-term surety, because equivalence can be withdrawn unilaterally by the EU at any point.
Yeah.
Now, that's the bit. That's where, you know, the London firms were always fearful of going for the equivalence model rather than actual single market participation, because essentially you don't have long-term.
This can probably bring us onto the next point. Is that I think the government is slowly starting to realise that there are a whole bunch of sectors, and I think that bunch is increasing by the day, that basically want to stay completely aligned with the EU's architecture. And so we saw the announcement that the EU Commission had sent out memos to companies in 15 sectors warning them about the implications of the UK becoming a third country. So it was these were companies who rely on a UK licence to operate. And we've got a call out to talk to any businesses which have had that memo, because we want to see it and we want them to talk to us about what they think. But this is something which the government hasn't really grasped yet, as we saw in the... Well, I mean, we can move on to the letter that was leaked that David Davis sent to Theresa May about the fact that David Davis is apparently very surprised and terrified. It was quite a passive-aggressive letter that the EU are actually making preparations.
The most ironic thing.
And talking to businesses about the fact that they're preparing for no deal and what that might mean for them. And then an EU Commission spokesperson said that we're very surprised, the UK is surprised that we're preparing for a scenario that the UK government itself announced. It's pretty...
I've got to say, it makes
me want to... Put my fingers to my lips like an Italian chef.
See, I can actually see the logic in both sides, but that statement by the EU, I don't know what it is. It's that sort of rules based statement. It's kind of, feels like I'm having an argument with my wife. It's just it's so cutting. It kind of gets me. I think I can't deal with this. I can't deal with this one bit. So you see it slightly differently there.
Yeah, but I think what the EU is doing is important, and for me is one of the roles we've been calling on the government to pull its finger out. And again, because government is pretending about where things might land, You know, the conversations we have with companies, you know, what are you preparing? Are you starting to have conversations? Can we help you in any way? The general thing that comes back is, oh, well, we don't know. We don't know where it's going to land, therefore we're not doing any preparation. That makes some sense to a certain degree. So the big international traders, those with integrated supply chains, are well down the planning route. For those who export less frequently, they're not. But the question we then have is, well, have you done your worst case scenario? Have you got your plans for an AD? Do you know what that means? For most companies, the answer is very, very clearly no. But at this stage, they still don't know that. And the EU government, the EU is now doing, you know, the European Commission is moving to do what the UK government should do, which is actually, this is what you need to think about.
I think the thing about preparing for a no deal is that it has to be reflected on both sides of the ports, both sides of the channel, both in Amsterdam and in Hull. It needs to be a binary system, because if you have complete preparation one side, if it's not reciprocated, that traffic doesn't go anywhere.
Exactly.
So there's no point.
The border always has two sides.
So in some ways the UK complaining about secrecy is in a sense correct, in that it needs to be a binary kind of open cooperative procedure. But I can understand, but there's still a tremendous amount of irony in the letter.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I've just got a quick one for all of them. Now that the Brexit process is underway, and I mean, I'll put my hand up, I had no idea the Brexit process was even half as complicated as it is until I met Alex and Christian. And now I think I've only got a small idea of how complex it actually is. Did you guys on the campaign understand how hard it was? And if you did, how did you go about trying to package that message to the voters?
Well, actually, have you read Tim Shipman's All Out War?
No.
I'd recommend it.
Yeah.
First of all, as a precursor, read it. Yeah. Dominic Cummings, his answer to this was, because everything is so complicated, simplify it all and squash it down into messages which are digestible. Because if you talk to the public as a campaign, if you talk to the public about rules of origin, accumulation, regulation, you get absolutely nowhere, because these things are difficult to I think I broadly understand them, but they're obviously not completely, nobody does. But you need to find ways of essentially ensuring that your messages are digestible. In terms of were there experts on the campaign? There were a couple, yeah. There were a couple of EU law experts. Our research team were very clever. Richard Howell and Oliver Lewis were very kind of I forget the word, but they knew what they were talking about in terms of EU law. Dominic Cummings is very good at understanding the way government works. He was a civil servant for many years, and he understands how government needs to kind of organise itself in terms of preparing for Brexit. So there were pockets of expertise in areas, but no person can cover it all. It's just complete. I describe it as a bottomless pit. When you learn about trade and you learn about what the EU does for us and its influence, for good or for bad, it's a completely bottomless pit, and it's a very frustrating process trying to learn it all, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah.
That's at least my take on it. Yeah.
So, I guess a follow-on from that would be, you've got the people writing the message. You've got some experts within your team.
Yeah.
Do you think it was your message that swung the votes for people to say Doncaster or Hull, or was it something else?
I put it down to three factors. One was our message. Control and money are very important to people, and they're digestible and they are powerful. Number two, the immigration, the issue of immigration was simply unavoidable, and it was a big thing, and it does touch. I don't know about Manchester, because I think Manchester is very Remain, if I'm correct. I don't know about surrounding
Greater
areas.
Manchester might not be.
There's three boroughs that voted leave out of the ten.
I'm guessing Oldham or somewhere like that.
So the regions, I think, cared about things like immigration. And the third factor was the Remain campaign, in my opinion, and I'm not just saying this because I'm biased, but I think the Remain campaign was genuinely awful. I think it was genuinely a bad campaign, and what I think we saw from the Remain side of things was a very bad strategic operation. And that can be seen in a number of ways. One of the most prominent mistakes that they made and kept making was they kept fronting people who the public just don't like. They kept doing it, and they weren't learning from it. So the people they were putting on our cameras and our TV screens were either threatening them with punishing budgets, or they were Gordon Brown, who nobody likes, Tony Blair, who nobody likes, the comedian, what's his name, with the beret, who nobody likes. People who just weren't gripping people. So I think these were the kind of three combination of factors which led to, I mean, history can be written in many different ways, but I think that we played our part. And I think to some people, control plus money for the NHS was a way of tying economics with the kind of quality of life argument, and I just think that there were so many ways you can approach this, and I think that we did contribute and we did persuade voters, and I think that if it were not for our designation and Farage had led the campaign, I think that we would have looked at defeat. I think we would have looked at maybe 45%, and they would have won by 55%. And it's very kind of it's difficult to break down, but I think there were just so many factors involved in it. It's hard to explain in one kind of sentence how it all came together.
Do you think any of the ways in which Vote Leave approached campaigning have made Brexit more difficult to deliver? I think it's fairly obvious that the government has. I mean, Theresa May was a Remain, was on the Remain side, and after coming to power, seemed to, you know, adopt some of the policies of the hardest Brexiteers.
Yeah, see, I mean, our general arguments, I don't think, compromise negotiations, in that we can, in principle, have control of our borders, we can have control of our trade policy, we can end the payments eventually, and some, I can't remember what all of our messages were now. Mm-hmm. In terms of our messages, I don't think they're very compromising. I genuinely think that lots of the mistakes came after the referendum. So, for instance, during the... First of all, the holding of the election was bizarre, completely bizarre. Yep. In hindsight, initially I supported it because I saw the logic in it, but then I realised that it just didn't work. But also before that, another crucial mistake was made, in that before Article 50 was invoked, there was no scoping in the way of understanding your opponents. Yeah. There was nothing in the way of scoping. And that right there was a massive opportunity missed. Yep. So I think that I've had my kind of fallouts and disagreements with Vote Leave people, but I genuinely think it's largely government and general attitude that's actually the problem, and not actually the campaign.
Yeah, I agree
entirely. I think one of the main arguments is that you just said it, is that we shouldn't have invoked Article 50 as quickly as we did, because we had absolutely no idea what we were getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely agree that's a huge mistake. And you also mentioned earlier on that you support the idea of extending the Article 50 period, which I completely do as well.
As an alternative to a transition,
I mean, we've spoken about the transition on this podcast before. I mean, I'm sure our views on that are dissimilar to yours, in that we're essentially putting ourselves in the worst position possible for two years.
I thought it was an implementation phase.
Call it what you will.
I don't know what that is.
The status quo, essentially, it is, for all the people who said, Norway is simply unacceptable because we will have to take rules we have no influence over, put to one side almost totally inaccuracy of that statement. The transition period as it currently stands will be literally the worst possible Norway-style position you can imagine. Of in everything, with absolutely no say.
Absolutely,
it's a bonkers position to see that as being a positive thing. Extend Article 50.
The only thing is, it's temporary. But even then, it's still a good 2 years of obeying by everything, abiding by everything, but not having any kind of voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like vassalage, which sounds like an extreme term, but that is really what it is.
It is. It is the UK voluntarily putting itself in the weakest possible position. I mean, if you wanted to, we're already seeing some of those moves in from both Germany and France, particularly around, there are some significant opportunities for us here, as those two nations, in terms of grabbing business stakes from the UK. That 2 year period is the perfect point at which you might want to, which the EU might want to start looking very closely at financial services regulation, positions of Eurozone clearing, all this kind of stuff, because actually, all of a sudden, you've not got the UK's voice at the table. It's a very weird way.
And that would be weird for us and our staff there, and all the diplomats we have over there, because the UK actually did have a strong voice in the EU.
Absolutely.
And I never argued that we had no say there. It would have been point. We would have left if we had no say there. It doesn't make sense to argue that. So to go from a position where you're actually one of the strongest countries, just from a say perspective, to go from that position of quite a relatively significant amount of say to no say is a complete culture shock to people there, I think.
Yeah.
And that's also worth considering.
I think another thing which perhaps people forget is that the position that we've asked to be put in for this transition implementation period isn't a position which currently exists and will have to be negotiated and figured out on, in a legal basis, and yeah, all that's going to take loads and loads of time. And everyone knows that we're in a massive time constraint anyway to get any of this done.
Mm.
The EU is good at political fudging on big issues.
Yes.
This has got, there are a couple of enormous hurdles here. The EU needs to somehow handle the WTO.
Yeah.
To say, actually, we need to give a third country full-blown access to our markets without transgressing any of the WTO rules. That's not necessarily
I mean, the reason why we constantly speak about the Norway option, I mean, you know, going back months on this podcast, was that it's as close as you can get to an off-the-shelf option. We kind of know what it is. You know, it's configurable. You know, it gets loads of problems off the table. Or at least
eliminates
goes partially to solving most of the problems that we have in one swoop, and that completely got avoided and got thrown out. And now we have this other one, which is to extend Article 50, which once again takes loads of the things which we need to negotiate off the table, solves the problem of the transition period, you know, gives us way more time to do everything else. And the government has also completely avoided that option.
The MEP issue, when I make this point, sometimes I get commentators saying to me, oh, but what about the MEP issue? We're going to have to elect new MEPs and they will have to outlast their term. But actually, I don't see that as being a big issue. Because if you look at, basically, it wouldn't be a provision in the article in the treaty and in Article 50 if it was just completely, if it were completely kind of quashed by this whole MEP, sticky MEP situation. So I don't see it as being a problem, but I agree with what you say.
One last bit, I'm sorry, Jonathan, I think it's the transition bit. Is the other bit that I'm still worried about. People say, oh, great, you know, we get the transition to the end of 2020, which is the Barnier and the EU position, or you extend the Article 50. Is the thing is that all that does still is boot a cliff edge nearly 2 years further down the road.
Yeah.
Until the UK government has worked out what it is it wants, you can just keep kicking this can as long as you like. All you do is you replace the 29th of March 2019 with the 31st of December 2020, but you still have the problem. The cliff edge is still there.
The destination unknown, yeah. So when you talk about what it wants, are you really looking at the moment about our relationship as far as the regulatory architecture, as in do we want an EEA based relationship or something else, like a Ukraine, or
I wouldn't want to put it into a box at this stage. I think because what we're missing from our point of view from the UK government is even a high level vision paper that says what the kind of relationship we are looking for is this, because, or even not is this, but it's the kind of relationship we want will be shaped by these particular five or six things. Actually, we are keen to ensure relatively functional borders, yada, yada, yada. What does all that add up to? And this is, of course, the problem. This goes all the way back to the start. We don't know why we're doing this.
No.
For us always the EA option. Look, actually, you get over the hurdle of ticking the referendum box. So even though people will still be furious that you're still in the single market and you've still got freedom of people, you're still accepting rules.
That's our free movement as well, by the way.
On the EFTA court, all of that. But fundamentally, you can turn around and say, the box you asked us to do, leave the EU, we have done. Argue around the edges, but you have a very clear political message doing that. And then broadly, from the business and the sheer economic point of view, with the exception of agriculture, fisheries and cover and things, you're basically status quo. And then over the next 10 or 15 years, you suddenly work out actually what it is you want to do with all these pounds you've suddenly found. And when you've got around to not even answering the questions, but working out what the questions you want to ask are, then you can start to do that. But this idea that it's all cart before the horse. We're trying to work out what it is, what the structures should be, whilst not knowing why we're doing this.
Are you all Remainers, by the way?
No,
I have had. Well, you can
well,
speak.
You're
I have no opinion. I'm not allowed one.
I'm also not allowed one. Not on this podcast, anyway.
Fair enough. I didn't realise. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
I can have an opinion, and I was a Leaver.
Okay.
And on balance, I still am.
It's just because we're a representative membership organisation. So our members were 55-35 in the very last poll we did before. 55 remain.
Okay.
35 leave. That was the narrowest it was out of all the polling. It started off at 65-30, I think. So it strengthened towards leave as the referendum went on. There was only one subset of our membership that was a majority vote for Leave, and that was exporting companies who do not trade with the EU.
Yeah.
So that was the only effect of the game as a majority.
And maybe just on that point, one of my proudest things which I like to tell people is that I used to go around for the Chamber doing Brexit presentations, you know, multiple times a week for a period of months, leading up to the referendum and shortly afterwards. And I have been told by people that they are very upset because I'm too pro Remain and that I'm too pro Leave when I've delivered exactly the same presentation.
Well, you know you've won. You know you've done well then. That's the idea. That well, and also that does that not reflect how completely partisan and toxic and poisonous the whole debate has become?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Well, and the majority debates that we have now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, just one last current affairs thing before we wrap it up. Who saw the Juncker speech? Basically warning all the other European countries that they're going to have to stump up once the UK leaves the EU.
Yes, yeah, the budget contract, of course, because the UK will leave a lot of holes in the EU, but I suppose the most obviously tangible one is about €16 billion, I think, is the expectation on the forecast a year.
How's Germany taking that?
Yeah, well, that's going to be interesting. Especially the specific German. Don't forget, Germany doesn't have a government at the moment, which might be helpful.
If France end up paying more, that's a success of Brexit, as far as I'm concerned.
And I think Juncker also said, you know, I don't like the idea of cuts. So basically, you're all going to stumble. Absolutely, cutting the budget is absolutely unthinkable. Therefore, Philip, it'll work out.
Yeah, I'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see who does actually foot this bill.
Well, don't forget, there's only 5 net contributors.
Yes,
we're one of them.
Germany, France,
Germany's
Italy,
yeah.
Austria, Holland. Is it?
Netherlands is just a net contributor, but the numbers. I mean, the other thing as well, actually, the UK and the German contributions are individually larger than the sum of the rest.
And the French, the reason why I mentioned the French before is because they demand a lot of contributions in terms of the common agriculture policy, and always have done.
For them,
yeah. So if anything, I think it's
huge. I mean, many people listening might not know, but it's at 35%, I think, of the EU's total spending budget is common agriculture policy.
And what's the rest of it? Pensions.
Pensions.
You are a cynical.
investment projects, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So CAP is a very big deal, and a very big deal for France.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Right, well, thank you all very much for contributing. Oliver, thank
you for having me.
Well, and also, don't stay down in the southeast bubble for I feel that Doncaster and Hull and all those other places may well benefit from your visit.
And follow me on Twitter, at Oliver Norgrove, if you'd like to.
If you'd like to.
Thank you.
Excellent. All right, well, the normal three of us will be back next week, I hope, unless there's anything in your diaries which means that we can't.
I think we shall be here at the usual time, usual place.
Excellent. Right, so until next week, goodbye.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.